You cannot lose games.
Games and still win games.
He's just baiting you into singing the song so he can put it at the top.
He's doing the thing.
This is all a long con.
Oh, wow.
So I'm not going to say anything
then. He even cut the theme short by doing that?
Neil, let's be quiet.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
Don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shutter.
In case you didn't know,
I got keyboard. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. With me in the room, Neil Payne.
Hey, Chad.
Hi, Neil.
How's it going?
You got the husky Neil voice going on today.
I just ate some M&Ms.
Oh, yeah.
That contributed. That's
a little scratch in your throat.
That's
a good product
secret.
Placement, though. And all the way up I-84, Kate Fagan in Bristol, Connecticut. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad. I'm off of exit 31.
Hey, that's an ESPN insider
joke.
It's
so inside baseball that happened there, but whatever.
All right. On today's show, Kate, sorry, before we get to it, this is what hour of your television radio appearance that you're on?
This is now the fourth hour.
Wow.
But I'm going to bring the heat.
Listeners
can... The hot, hot heat.
I feel like listeners should be able to, donate and sponsor your radio and TV marathon, you know, like a walkathon, but just a talkathon.
But hopefully just with hot takes.
Yeah, they donate with their hot takes. I like it. All right. On today's show, how much is a quarterback worth? The Rams are trying to find out. ESPN's Bill Barnwell will join us to break down the mega trade between the Rams and Titans and return to our never ending debate about the right draft strategy. And then we'll light a candle for Kobe Bryant, basketball Sisyphus. We'll discuss the tragedy of his career and how it encapsulated two decades worth of change in the NBA. And finally, Allison McCann will join us to talk about the new season in the National Women's Soccer League, bringing fancy stats about which team is projected to win, how the league differs from the Women's National League Soccer that we're used to watching. All right. You guys ready for football?
Always ready.
Let's do it.
The Rams and Titans traded a bushel of draft picks last week, all so that the Rams could get the number one pick. The Titans will now have 6 of the first 76 picks in this year's draft, and some first-rounders still to come next year. The Rams, meanwhile, have a shot at a couple quarterbacks that nobody seems that in love with. Bill Barnwell, ESPN's Bill Barnwell, help us make sense of this trade. Hello, Bill.
How's it going?
Thanks for being with us. I think your sophomore voyage on Hot Takedown, is that right?
I think of it more like just when you get on for the first time, you're just there, in perpetuity. You never really hop off.
Oh, I like it. You've been in the studio this whole time. I'm
glad
we've been feeding
lonely.
You.
I like that.
All right. So before we get in, let's first listen to a take. Here's Adam Schein from the Schein on Sports Show, telling why the Rams trade with the Titans is a game changer for both teams.
Wow. Every once in a while, you get a transaction. You get a trade. You get something that makes you stop dead in your tracks. We said if the Titans can get a haul for that number one overall pick, you go ahead and you do it. If the Rams have an opportunity to go get a franchise quarterback, you go ahead, you do it.
Wow, that is a hotness of that take is
soundtrack.
Unbelievable.
I feel exhausted.
There was volume that happened.
Well,
after
it's because
the
you died
happened.
In your tracks, Bill. That's why you're exhausted. All right, so Bill, you've written on this at ESPN.com. We'll put some links on our show page. But just tell us, is that hyperbolic take right? Do you just do it when presented with this opportunity?
I mean, it's. I don't know that it's an opportunity that I would be so excited to have the possibility of getting. It's sort of like having the opportunity to invest in a multi-level marketing scheme. Like, sure, it's an opportunity, but I don't know that I would be super excited about the possibility of actually investing in it. Without getting into the details on whether I think Jared Goff or Carson Wentz are they're going to be the quarterback of the future for a given team, because I don't know. I think the reality is, I don't know that the Rams know. I mean, this is a team that, as recently as a month ago, were telling us Case Keenum was going to be their starter and had faith in him. A team that invested in Sam Bradford for years and kept him on for years, and a team that you know, traded for Nick Foles. They've gone through various options at quarterback and they haven't worked. And now, instead of saying, okay, well, we don't really know what we're doing and we should maybe just try something a little different, they're doing something different, but they're doubling down on their knowledge of quarterbacks and investing several first-round picks and acquiring a rookie quarterback. And it's a level of certainty that I think is probably unearned given their recent past in terms of evaluating quarterbacks.
Well, Bill, I'm wondering, because we've talked a lot this week on other ESPN platforms about this concept of perhaps there's a QB bubble happening mm-hmm. here, because you see Brock Osweiler getting paid a dollar figure that maybe seems higher than the value he's shown. And now you see the Rams trading a lot of future assets in the hopes of getting a QB, and it's not even necessarily a QB prospect that universally has been praised. When you look at just the QB market, is it possible that they're just reacting to what is the actual QB market right now and whether there's like a bubble there?
It's possible. I mean, I think that, you know, quarterbacks are always in need. There's never enough quarterbacks to go around. But I think the counterexample to that is someone like Tyrod Taylor in Buffalo, right, where he was basically, not only did he get the minimum, he got the minimum with a team option for a second year at the minimum. And maybe he could have got him more as a backup, but took that much because he wanted to have an opportunity to get a starting job. And he was probably a league average quarterback, maybe even a little better given his running ability. I mean, of course, it wasn't a prototypical offense. They had to sort of mold some things around his strengths and weaknesses, but that's what a good offensive coordinator should do anyway. So, I mean, if anything, I think I'd say, sure, there's a bubble in terms of getting guys like Brock Osweiler, who is 7'5" and looks like a quarterback, but maybe what that should do, instead of having you invest more to try and get a quarterback like that, is to try and find another idea of what a quarterback might look like or how he might play.
Now, Bill, is there anything to this issue, some of the kind of apologetics that I read in favor of the trade but that the Rams made sort of talked about how, well, this team is a quarterback away, and they have, you know, they seem to say that the rest of the roster, you know, it's fine to build up the roster and make good incremental moves when you can, but if you already have good pieces on the roster, and we have to eventually talk also about the haul that they got from the RG3 trade, which is kind of this mirrored, that if you are a quarterback away from contention, that does it make more sense to, you know, maybe if it doesn't even justify it completely, it justifies it a little bit more to make a move like this to the top of the draft to try to target a QB?
Maybe, but I mean, it's not as if they're trading for Aaron Rodgers. You know, if you were trading for a guy who had been a superstar in the NFL, I could see it, because, you know, they were 7th in DVOA last year, have Todd Gurley, who's obviously a phenomenal running back. A very young team. I think the youngest team in football, or certainly one of the youngest teams in football, depending on how you measure age. So I could see that logic, but they're not trading for a sure thing. They're trading for, at best, a question mark. Someone who, whether it's Goff or Wentz, who's not, you know, guaranteed to be a success in any means. And I think, given that that's the case, I don't know if they're a quarterback away, but I don't know that the quarterback they're getting is any better than the guys they have currently.
So it sounds like a lot of this is just the overconfidence factor, that I know that there's a lot of research out there that shows that teams, you know, sort of are more confident in their ability to pick the best player available at a given position than perhaps they should be.
Yeah, and I think you've written about that, and a lot of people have, and I think there's a definite reality to that, in that, you know, and if anyone should have seen this, it's the Rams, given that, like you mentioned, they were the benefit of this sort of trade, where Washington traded for Robert Griffin under the logic that they needed to get that franchise quarterback, and he absolutely was not the guy. I mean, he was incredible for a year, but injuries and probably to some extent, you know, off-field conflicts in terms of personalities clashing, you know, cost him his time there. And I don't think Washington would look back and make that trade again. Of course they wouldn't. And the Rams would obviously make that trade every day of the week if they could again. So the fact that now they're the ones who are saying, oh, actually, well, we can do this better than Washington did, it just seems like it's a real confidence that I don't know I would feel if I were them.
Bill, if I can ask you to kind of jump into the psychologizing about this mode, it seems to me, if I look back on times when I've been motivated to use a lot of resources for something, it's always motivated by the actual thing I want, right? Because it's hard to just get amped up to give up a lot for the right to a selection. You know, it was like I was on His and Hers, and they're like, before you go into a club, don't you want to know who's in the club, in a way? Mm-hmm. Before you pay that kind of value for it, doesn't it seem to you like, even if the Rams are saying they don't know who they're going to pick, like, why would they have given up so many assets if they're not sure who fits into their system and who works from the larger scheme for them.
Right. I think the idea that they would make this trade not knowing who they were going to take is insane.
Right.
I think that's crazy. But then at the same time, I don't really know what the benefit would be to not mentioning it. I don't think they made the trade trying to get another trade for more picks. I don't think, you know, I don't think that they are in a situation where, you know, they're going to try and negotiate a better deal with the pick, because it's really a slotted figure. You know, maybe 6, 7, or 8 years ago, before the old CBA, before the new CBA, I should say, you had to negotiate with the picks. And so there was some nuance to that, but that's really not going to be the case here. So really, I mean, I guess what it leads me to believe, right or wrong, is that they're sort of in a place where there's some disagreement within the organization. And I think, you know, maybe the people who were involved in making this trade feel one way, and some of the people who are, you know, whether it's whether it's Les Snead, or whether it's Jeff Fisher, whether it's ownership, the Kroenkes, you know, it's hard to say who's on what side, but I would imagine that there are different people on different sides of this debate. And, you know, the people making the trade are not necessarily the people who are going to be, or I guess the people who are making the final decision, but maybe they are willing to hear out other decisions before they make up their mind.
Let's talk about the Titans end of this, too. They have that's a lot of draft picks that they brought in. And we just got done last week talking about the Hinkie era 76ers and whether or not just hoarding draft picks in the NBA is a worthwhile strategy. In the NFL, if I remember our previous hot takedown conversations correctly, it's even more of a wise strategy to hoard draft picks and try and have as many as possible and exploit, and as Kate said, sink resources more diversely within to put financial terminology into it, within a portfolio of players. So, mm-hmm. So Bill, is there any way that the Titans screwed this up?
I mean, of course they could screw it up. They could trade a bunch of picks and trade back up for something, and that's not out of the question. They could, you know, make poor selections. That's also not out of the question. But I think they put themselves in the best possible situation to succeed. I think they're, you know, their organization unchanged with the first overall pick and with this bevy of picks is much better with the latter situation. And, you know, there's no guarantees in the NFL, but the chances of them finding useful players with 7 picks is a lot higher than it is with 1 pick, even if that pick is the first overall pick.
Right, and at some point, it's better to have more picks later in the round and later in the first round and going into the early second round than it is to have a pick. I mean, they have the number one pick, but then it is to sort of lie in the trough in between the top 5, I think it is, and the later ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that was, I think, more prevalent back before the slotting process in terms of the salaries that were being handed out to players. But
what do you mean by slotting process?
In terms of the way that contracts were parceled out, mm-hmm. and that contracts were negotiated based on the previous year's deal, with usually a typical increase, but now it's basically a locked-in figure that most players agree to without any issues. I don't remember the last time that was really a holdout. But under any circumstances, I think those tend to be the best sort of picks in terms of, you know, they're undervalued to some extent by the broader community, but they're also, you know, the difference between a high second round pick and a low first round pick, or even a moderate or medium level first round pick, really is not that significant. So, I do think they're in a very good spot. And again, I think where they are right now, it's just much better. I mean, they really were not going to take a quarterback with the first overall pick. So they had to really convince the league that they were going to get a great trade offer. Or take an offensive tackle, and they convinced the league successfully that they were going to take Laremy Tunsil because they got this offer, and Cleveland in the second slot did not.
All right, and one last data point, and then we have to move on because we're a bit pressed for time today, which is that there's this sort of idea about surplus value that draft picks can have, and I think you wrote about this, that based on this model, the Rams in this trade got only $3.6 million in surplus value, while the Titans got $13.1 million in surplus value because of all these extra picks. And so there is, and surplus obviously depends on where you spend it, as you mentioned, but there is certainly a hoarding of resources that could be put to better use down the line for the Titans. Mm-hmm. All right, so Bill, before we let you go, tell us about you. You have a new podcast coming. Tell us about what it's going to be.
I do. It's very exciting. It's called The Bill Barnwell Show.
Innovative.
Yeah, it's going to feature me, unsurprisingly, perhaps, given the name. Yeah, it's going to be basically just hopefully a smart, funny show about sports. It's going to be about an hour long. We're going to talk about football a lot, but also some other topics that are not football. Going to try and get some different voices out there, people who maybe you've read on Twitter, or people who you've read writing of, who you want to hear more about. But just, it's going to be a good conversation. Not like my old podcast necessarily, not like the Grantland NFL podcast, but something closer to just a general sports talk show, which you can now subscribe to on iTunes by going to the Grantland Sports feed. You can go to my Twitter. I'll be tweeting at Bat of the Bunch, or in the near future, we'll have the Barnwell Show Twitter account set up that you can find the links for the shows from there. But we have an episode with Chris Sproul talking about the NFL draft, and an episode with Kevin Pelton of ESPN Insider talking about the NBA playoffs going up this week. So yeah, please check it out.
Cool. All right. So listeners, that is the Grantland Sports Zombie podcast feed that that Bill is, you're inhabiting its brain and eventually turning it to your whims. Bill, thanks so much for joining us. Hope to talk to you soon.
My pleasure, guys.
With 11 minutes and 25 seconds remaining in the first quarter of his last game, Kobe Bryant took a shot from the three-point line. This would become a theme. 49 shots from the field later, the Lakers won. Kobe dropped a mic, and a career came to a close. It was a singular performance. Kobe shot 50 times, scoring 60 points, leading come from behind victory, and dominated the Lakers offense like the old days. It was also a terribly inefficient one. Here are the guys from the starters discussing Kobe's final game.
That was
pretty
awesome.
Iconic. That was the perfect Kobe send-off. It would have been like if Jordan actually stayed retired after winning in 1998. Mm. Just the perfect way to go out, shooting as much as you can, literally dragging the team back. Last 3 minutes and 4 seconds, 5 of 5 from the field, 4 of 4 from the line, and an assist. I 100% now believe in the hot hand and also that Kobe's clutch, and there's no way you can ever change my mind because that's how he went out, dragging his team back to win it, shooting every single time. It was perfect.
Wow, his belief in clutch was proven by someone winning over the Utah Jazz for their 17th win of the season on the last game.
Hoping that was like a huge heaping helping of sarcasm that happened right there.
All right, so, but I am interested in this question because I do feel like I saw it perpetuated, or I saw the narrative perpetuated after Kobe's game, that this was Kobe Bryant's career in a microcosm, that this one game showed us everything that he had to offer. Is that true, or is that a vast oversimplification of all Kobe was?
I mean, let's just, to be honest about it, his usage rate in that game was 62.4%. That is an astoundingly high rate.
And just for our listeners, that means
62.4% of the Lakers' offensive possessions
ended with Kobe
doing something.
give us like the NBA average, just so we have.
So the NBA average by definition is 20% because there's 5 players on the floor to split 100 percentage points.
So he was three players worth.
D'Angelo Russell and Jordan Clarkson were around 15% apiece, and then nobody else who played significant minutes really came close to them. So, yeah, let's be clear about the fact that for Kobe's career, he had a very high usage rate by player season standards or career standards, but not to this extent. He was around about probably 30-35% for his career, I'd say. So he
doubled his persona in his final game.
Yeah, and I take issue with the idea that it was a horribly inefficient game too. I mean, his true shooting percentage, his offensive rating, individual offensive rating in the game, those were above the NBA average for the season. So it wasn't
a 6-for-24 follow-up.
It was not the fabled 6-for-24 performance
of his 2010 Finals Game 7.
That's right. Yeah, but maybe that in a way, the fact that we have this perception that it was inefficient is emblematic of Kobe's career, because I think the rap on him as he went on with his career, and maybe as the Lakers got worse and certainly as he got older and worse, was that he was single-handedly dragging them down with selfish ball-hogging play, and that he wasn't really an efficient player. And that was true at the twilight of his career. But for the entirety of his career, I think in a lot of statistical circles, and I wrote about this last week, he probably didn't get as much credit as he deserved, this might have also been an example of that, this final game, where people pointed out the 50 shots, but he didn't exactly misuse all 50 of those shots.
And a lot of the reason why it was a microcosm was also because there was so much meat on the bone to produce divisiveness, which is what Kobe has always done. And it seems like throughout his career, almost everything he did was looked at through two lenses, which was one, like, diehard Kobe fans who, no matter what he did to them, it felt like this legend pursuing greatness, like, everyone else be damned. And then the other crew of people sort of pointing out constantly that there was a level of narcissism and inefficiency at certain points during his career. And, like, the way he left that specific game allows us to dive into all of those arguments once again. And, Neil, I'd love to hear, because you mentioned it, that in certain ways, as we've looked over his career and as analytics have developed, we've been able to pinpoint certain layers of inefficiency that Kobe had that perhaps Jordan didn't have. And that's always the comparison, because Kobe made it the yes. comparison by the specific way that he spoke. But you mentioned that in a lot of ways he didn't get enough credit. Kobe didn't. Like, in what ways do you think that when we're speaking about stats, he didn't get enough credit?
Well, I think especially in roundabout when he peaked, actually. But when he peaked was also when the analytics movement was sort of first hitting the big time, and it had just started to invade front offices and become sort of a talking point that people in the legitimate media, instead of sort of at the fringes of the blogosphere, were talking about. And so at that point, you had a lot of people who were kind of still looking at basketball through the lens of baseball and metrics that sort of valued efficiency over everything else. And that the idea that, you know, there was no value to creating your own shot, that Kobe, you know, just, you know, his teammates, if he hadn't shot it, his teammates would have been able to score at just as high of a rate, and that there was no sort of benefit to having this center of gravity that, you know, took a lot of defensive attention away from his teammates while he was on the floor. And so by judging him through that metric, he comes out as kind of an average player, maybe a little bit above average, but certainly not an all-time great player. I think as we've matured in the analytics movement, we've started to appreciate the value of somebody that makes things easier for their teammates. And this is kind of an Allen Iverson argument, a Carmelo Anthony argument also. A lot of these guys that got a lot of hate during the first generation of basketball analytics, things have kind of softened toward them and viewed them in a more favorable light, because we've had better ways to analyze the things that they do well, and also just more of a fuller view of the game of basketball, which is kind of ironically brings you back to some of the older school ideas about how, you know, having someone who can create on the floor really makes things a lot easier for a five-man unit, as long as that person is not just horrifically chucking. And you know, you can say what you want about Kobe, but I think, you know, he was about winning. Certainly he wanted to do it his way, and he wanted to be the reason why the team was winning. And that was, you know, a source of great strife throughout his career. But also at the same time, you know, he oftentimes was saddled with players like Smush Parker and so, people like that.
So I feel like I've read a lot about how the league doesn't have Kobe's anymore.
That's true.
And so you think that's true, despite what you've just said, which is that analytics now appreciates these kinds of players who can make things easier on their teammates, that you think Kobe is part of a dying breed and we do have more team-focused players. And then my follow-up is, does that make the league a quote-unquote better place? Like, let's start here. Who is the Kobe Bryant now of the NBA?
I mean, there's a lot of guys that are in that mold. I think about DeMar DeRozan,
so
Rudy Gay.
We would call them, what, gunners now, I guess?
Well, I mean, they're still swingmen that are scorers, and maybe they're slashers or whatever you would call it. But
swing slash gunners?
Sure. But I think the way to kind of, you know, there are players, just from a strict kind of usage perspective, there's a bunch of players that take as many possessions that go through them as Kobe. Russell Westbrook just last year, I think, either set or almost came close to breaking Kobe's record for the highest single season usage rate. But at the same time, the way in which these players, you know, high usage players are scoring, there was a great article by Seth Partnow at Vice Sports this week talking about how the style of play that Kobe does, the mid-range, you mm-hmm. know, scorer, that is definitely dying in the NBA as we kind of come to this. We've talked about it many times in the show.
And is the league, Kate, go ahead, Kate.
Well, do you think when we try to then parse out the why, is it like the back spin backlash to the AAU argument that was always the case, whereas like during Kobe's time, it was like there was a lot of AAU guys, and then it seemed like we morphed into now where guys are coming to the league. They are following more of the there is no one and done. At least they're going to a college for a little bit. We've got the Golden State Warriors team. You've got LeBron as the superstar for so many years, who has a high usage rate, but also a high efficiency rate as well. Is there any way to understand the why of the move away from sort of the gunner scorer mentality?
I think it's the why is mostly about shot selection, right? Like the idea that, you know, long two-pointers and you know, it's not a secret anymore. I don't know if it ever was a secret or hasn't been for a long time that, you know, mid-range shots are worth less and less efficient. And so if you have players, you know, suited to those roles, and Seth also made a great point that players that were three-point shooters back when Kobe entered the game, they were considered the role players. They were considered the guys that you would, you know, have somebody create from the wing and kick out to. But now having that element of long distance shooting to your game is sort of a requirement to be a big time scorer if you look at like Kevin Durant and people like that across the league.
So, Kate, I'm curious from your perspective, you know, what's the platonic ideal of the NBA? Do we want a balance of swing slash gunners along with these sort of team focused high efficiency players, or do we want a sort of like technocratic vision of the NBA where maybe you have a lot of team-focused individuals, but maybe not as marketable of personalities and stars?
I mean, you know, I'm always going to lean toward what provides better like storytelling and drama. And the Golden State Warriors are phenomenal basketball to watch, mm-hmm. but there does come a time where because there's so little inefficiency on that team that you almost wonder where they go from here and how they continue to be interesting because there's almost like a rhythmic beat to them and there's not as much ups and downs.
Do they just become the Spurs?
Right, and it's great when you have – it was great to have the Spurs when you had Kobe and the Lakers because over here it was like this – scorer who was just going to put someone on their backs and there was a different style and then, you know, you had to have Gasol and then the triangle and the pinch post and all that other pieces, but that was that storyline and it was balanced again against this like Spurs efficiency and that worked because you had the yin yang going on. The NBA now is so much less, there's so many few, as we just talked about, there's so many few just dynamic scorers who maybe even practice like spinning fadeaways along the baseline to match against these types of super teams that are based on like railroad efficiency. I don't think you want an NBA where you've got a bunch of teams that are all playing like the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Kobe that people talked about during his career, and I think it's kind of a shame that we really only have like a couple years at the tail end of his career to actually have, you know, Sport VU cameras to track this, is Kobe was one of the best at making difficult shots of anybody that I've seen just anecdotally, and certainly I think the recent numbers would back that up. And but it goes to the point of shot selection and things that you mentioned. Nobody is practicing some of the shots, or you're discouraged from taking some of the shots that are the most difficult because it just from an analytical point of view and a logical point of view, it doesn't make sense to take so many shots that are tough when you can generate shots that are easier or at least higher yield in terms of average points. So I do wonder, and I think you guys are right, that without someone like Kobe, we are moving away from the practice of seeing the artistry of somebody knock down an incredibly difficult shot and appreciating the sheer degree of difficulty to it. But at the other side, I can appreciate why teams, you know, and coaches are not keen on letting players take a steady diet of difficult shots because it just doesn't make sense.
I mean, it's like we are seeing Steph Curry make these shots that
but to him, they're not even that difficult.
The difference to me is there's no recklessness. Like, right. With Kobe, even though it was practiced, like people will actually tell you when he hit those ridiculous shots, you thought that he just improvised in the moment, and he had practiced so many of these types of difficult shots, but there was still a recklessness to his game. And though we see Steph Curry hitting shots that in our mind seem so far out of reach from what we once predicted we would see in the NBA. There's not necessarily a recklessness to it that that as humans you can kind of revel in.
Yeah, I also sort of think back to sort of what I was like as a kid watching Kobe, and like, and what 12-year-old boys and girls are thinking when they're watching Steph Curry. And I'm not sure there's a difference in their minds between watching Curry and Bryant, because crazy shots are going in. You know, it's only when you get to sort of the more adult approach to the game and the more rational approach do you start to distinguish between these two players. We have to wrap, but I just want to say for once and for all, because we talked about Jordan a little bit, Neil, you put together a table about who is better, Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, and you have some bad news for Kobe.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's always, and you mentioned it too, Kate, that is the point of comparison, and Kobe asked for it in a lot of ways. He certainly didn't shy away from it, and everyone in the media insisted on making that comparison for so many years. And no matter how you look at it statistically, it just is not really that much of a contest. Jordan, by any metric that you want to look at, we put up a bunch of ones. We looked at, you know, his overall game, whether you look at box plus minus, that's a kind of metric of you know, how good we would predict that you would make your team while on the floor. We looked at the offensive efficiency when he ended possessions, the defense. The defense is the big thing, even. I think it's even bigger than on offense, is that Jordan was a legitimately fantastic defender. Bryant, despite winning all of those all-defensive nods, was actually not very good defensively for big chunks of his career, and you can even see that with the Laker teams that he played on were not good. So Jordan, in the end, wins no contest over Kobe.
Sorry, Kobe. I called you Sisyphus for a reason. All right, let's leave it there and get to women's soccer. Over the weekend, the National Women's Soccer League started its fourth season, a feat that the previous two professional women's soccer leagues in the U.S. never achieved. To mark the occasion, 538 has developed a power ranking system to track teams' progress during the season. Who's up, who's down, who will win, who will lose. To tell us about that power ranking system and just to talk about NWSL in general, it's Allison McCann. Hello, Allison.
Hey, Chad. That was a beautiful intro.
I think I stole most of it from your piece. all right. So, Allison, describe for us what this is. Can we call it a model? What do we call it? A ranking system is doing.
Yeah, I think it still counts as a model. Right. Most models they call power rankings, right?
Yeah.
Also, yeah, it's a pretty simple model. It's just based on three seasons of wins, losses, home and away. And we actually used a few NCAA games to inform, you know, some of the newer teams that were added and players that had a lot of rookies coming out of college and things like that. So. Has a few bells and whistles.
Okay, and who? I mean, give us the power ratings. Who are the preseason favorites? I know things have changed after one game, but
yeah. So these odds aren't updated with everybody played their first games this weekend. The model is also a little more manual, so we haven't ran an update. So I guess these figures were right before the opening games. We had two favorites, Seattle and Kansas, with the Seattle Reign projected to win the title at 31%.
Kansas, though, had won the last two titles.
Correct, yeah. Seattle was the best team in the regular season for two seasons and then lost to Kansas in the playoffs. However, both of these teams went on to lose their opening games, of course.
That model's making a great debut.
Which is exciting because I think I wrote a little bit about the piece, how, you know, some retirements and several pregnancies this year that could affect these teams. So yeah, we're gonna update, I think, after there's been a few more games and kind of work out some of the teams are looking at, you know, 11 new players on the roster and stuff, so they look entirely different than last year.
Allison, I know we've had on Hot Take Game, we had Sue Bird come on and talk about the dearth of numbers and analytics specifically in the WNBA, and then here up in Bristol I ran into one of our specific analytics women who's on for college basketball, and she was talking about the process of going back through WNBA tapes, because now it's been 20 years. If somebody wanted to go and create more advanced stats for the WNBA, and she was like, well, maybe the WNBA itself, there would be value in having that to help the storytelling. I'm wondering, as you put together this model and just in women's soccer in general, like, how, I'm assuming the model maybe is less I don't know, I don't want to say reliable, but like because there's less data, I'm assuming there's less fueling and there's less nuance and intricacy, right?
Yeah, totally. So we don't have anything with players, which is a huge part of any model because there isn't these very sophisticated player stats. So it's just on wins and losses and home and away and stuff. So yeah, we're not getting any nuance in trades and people getting injured and things like that. So hopefully once we... once those sorts of stats are available, then we'll be able to, you know, slide them right in.
I mean, Neil, you've made many models. What would...
More than a few.
What would... I mean, what would they have been like if you did not have player data? I mean, what... How... What magnitude of loss would it be as far as the insight that they were able to generate?
I mean, I would say that most of it would still be retained because, you know, you're just looking, even looking at team level results still gives you like a pretty good idea. You know, if you used ELO ratings, that's something that we have used a lot here at 538 that just you plug in the scores of the games and who the teams played and it kind of spits out a rating. I think when there's massive shakeups, and you could speak to this, Allison, more than I could about like how much player movement there was or is in a given NWSL offseason, for instance, because in a lot of the sports on the men's side, they're particularly baseball or the NBA, there isn't always, you know, a huge amount of change from year to year in the player base unless somebody like a LeBron James switches teams. And then you can throw everything out the window. Cleveland's rating when he left for Miami and then when he came back probably was pretty inaccurate at first, and I don't know how much you run the risk of that. And also soccer, I would imagine the impact of one singular player is less than it would be for, you know, a LeBron-like player. But I don't know. What are your thoughts, Allison?
Yeah, totally. There was a new franchise added this year, Orlando, that picked up perhaps many would call the LeBron James of women's soccer, Alex Morgan. And so we didn't have a good way to sort of say, you know, what that would mean for Orlando. And so, yeah, as franchises are added, where, you know, they automatically get 2 to 3 national team players. So there is still quite a bit of movement in the offseason that we're not capturing as much. But I do think for the most part, this year there was, I think, 2 coach swaps. But, you know, the coaches are staying the same for 3-4 years, the styles of play. And, yeah, like, even if one person retires, like, hopefully it's just a similar player fitting into that framework. So I don't think that they're terrible, but because we don't have these certain things. So
well, if I can ask, sorry, sort of a behind-the-scenes process question, Neil or Allison, if someone wanted to take the 20 years of WNBA history and all they cared about was creating the types of advanced stats for the WNBA that mirrored the NBA, what kind of time investment are we talking about?
So they do
have...
Is
that so ridiculous?
No. Okay. I mean, there are records, and basketballreference.com even has, because when we did our Sue Bird segment, I was able to calculate the greatest WNBA players of all time and kind of assign player ratings, which is sort of a cut above just the basic using the scores of the games and everything like that. So a lot of that groundwork for something like the WNBA is in place. I think once you start getting... It's kind of weird because the next level of stats is something like Sport VU, which, you know, needs to have cameras installed and people, you know, actually monitoring it and putting it into place in the arenas. And that isn't really feasible from the standpoint of, you know, a small group of people or like one person without some buy-in from the league itself. And we asked Adam Silver about that when we had him on the show, right, Kate? And he was kind of, you know, non-committal about it and sort of like the some arenas, you know, if the WNBA team shares an arena with an NBA team, then it by definition has the cameras, but they didn't seem ready to put in the cameras for non-NBA arenas. But just to go back, I think that there might be a missing generation there with like between the basic level stats and sort of like the baseline of advanced stats that you could calculate for any basketball league that you have with, you know, just the box score stats and the player ratings from that, and then the quantum leap forward to something like SportVU. What we did in the middle of those was we had people sort of just go to the games and do the brute force work of tracking things that didn't get tracked in the box score. So that's probably where the big time commitment in the next generation of stats for the WNBA would come.
Allison, do you know if the NWSL has that kind of effort underway for its own games?
Yeah, they've had a ton of movement this offseason by fans. There's this guy on Twitter who's like, whoa, so stats or something, women's soccer stats. And he's crowdsourcing to have people take portions of every game. So it'll be like, you know, first half of Seattle versus New Jersey. Can you track stats and stuff? So people are signing up. And cool. He's had, I mean, this was weekend one, but I had all the games tracked by people. And so, yeah, I think if you can prove that there is like this fan interest and people are doing it themselves, then you'll have a greater case right. with the league to install $1 million cameras.
So one more thing about what people are going to see on the field, and they can watch on Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports 2 probably as well, because the league has a deal with Fox Sports. Are they going to, when I watch the NWSL, am I going to see similar tactics that I saw during the World Cup with the women's national team, or is the NWSL sort of like an incubator for different strategies within women's soccer, and people are trying to still figure out, you know, what may work best and what may work better, both for a club and a national team?
Yeah, I think it will. This year probably may be the first year that it will start to maybe look a little bit different. There's been quite a few more international players that have came over, but before the league was like 90%
and so they
Americans.
Grew up within a certain system.
And I think that system of U.S. women's soccer is pretty like ingrained, but and because of the way, you know, the league is set up, every team has two or three national team players, if not five or six, for people in the player pool. So you know how you have a good core base of people that are you know, playing the Jill Ellis system.
And are those players generally the stars of the team, the best players on the team, or are there players that kind of are outside of the national team system that can kind of influence and mold the way that a team plays?
Yeah, it's funny because I think it's sort of these players that are usually in the player pool but don't maybe get called up to go to the World Cups and the Olympics that have really been successful in the NWSL. Allie Long comes to mind in Portland, kind of these like players that everybody wants to be on the national team but just remain with their club team the whole season, because when it's an Olympics or World Cup season, those national team players are leaving, you know, for 2 to 3 weeks every, you know, month or two. So they're really, you know, they're kind of come in and out and not at the central part of this team. And I think this weekend was super exciting because all the national team players were there, and yet we saw probably some of the rookies and a few international players were some of the most exciting people that I saw play this weekend. So it wasn't like just like, oh, this, you know, national team stars. Like, so now I think people are getting to, you know, find other names and people that they like on their club team, a little more club affiliation than just like national team spillover.
So one last thing, it's sort of a little mini significant digit. With the creation of the Orlando Pride, the NWSL now has 5 teams of its 10 with team names that do not end in an S. And this is a hobby horse of mine. I will list them all now. Spirit, Sky Blue, Flash, Dash, and Pride. This is a trend in women's sports. In the WNBA, there is the Liberty, the Sun, the Dream, the Sky, the Fever, the Storm, the Mercury, the Lynx.
But not the Sky Blue.
Not the Sky Blue. And I just so badly want to read about why it is that women's team nicknames don't end in S.
Chad, aren't you an editor
rate?
At a sports outlet? Why don't you assign a piece?
Why don't you write this together? I know. I really want to write the piece. But the point is that over 50% of women's club sports teams in the country do not end in S, compared to what I would assume would be probably 5% in the men's leagues. And I think that's a really interesting, I think there's some gender theory that can be done. That's all I'm saying.
I think so too. I'd be interested to see the comparison between the prevalence of this for women's league teams and for men's league expansion teams since like the 90s, when, you know, the women's leagues were starting to gain steam and grow to national prominence. Because it could be it's probably a combination of both just ridiculous kind of gender stereotyping going in, but also all of the classic names are taken and or seem stale.
I don't think that's it. I'm with Lions. No.
Think about all the MLS teams are like also Galaxy.
The Thunder, the Galaxy.
So this is the mystery. Is it about time or is it about the idea that we think of women as part of a collective?
It's probably both.
Yeah. All right. Coming soon to a hot takedown segment.
Did we just do the sig dig as well?
No, we got a different sig dig, but that's a good sig dig.
A mini sig dig.
All right. Allison McCann, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read all of Allison's NWSL work with her colleague Jay Boyce at 538. Kobe.com. All right, now it is time for our significant digit. When someone brings us a number, a telling number from the world of sports, this week's Sig Dig offerant, person with the Sig Dig, is Neil Payne. Hello,
that's
Neil.
Right. Hey, Chad.
Good to have you back with us.
I literally never left.
What do you have for, what is our Sig Dig this week?
So today's Sig Dig is 341. That is Bryce Harper of the Washington Nationals batting average. And you might think, oh, well, what's the big deal about that? He hit 330 last year, but 341 in the first, you know, handful of weeks of the season, that's not outrageous or beyond the pale. But the reason why it's really interesting to me, at least, is because his batting average on balls in play is only 242. So just to kind of give some background on BABIP.
So wait, so one would assume that BABIP would have to be high if batting average was high because BA is in BABIP. Correct?
Right, exactly. Your batting average on balls in play is typically higher, in fact, often much higher than your batting average on balls not in play. Because if you think about it, the only batting average events that can take place with the ball not being in play are strikeouts and home runs. Walks don't factor into batting average. So you would think that that it would be, you know, the league average batting average is around 260 or so, and the league average BABIP is around 300. But in Harper's case, it's gone in the opposite direction. And the reason why is because he's hit more home runs than he has strikeouts. He has 6 home runs as of this taping and 4 strikeouts. And if you look back, the kind of phenomenon of someone having a higher batting a BABIP that low under 270 and still hitting at in the 330-340 range, that used to happen with some, it used to be rare, but it wasn't insanely rare. Like Ralph Kiner, he hit 310 with a BABIP of 267 in 1949. A bunch of guys from the past, and of course Barry Bonds in 2001 also had similar numbers. He hit 328 despite a 266 BABIP, but you just don't see it so much these days outside of Bonds, who was a superhuman freak of nature and of science, of course, that because people strike out so much more nowadays. I was listening to a Mets broadcast the other day in which they said that for the majority of Joe DiMaggio's career, he actually had more home runs than he had strikeouts for his career, which is unthinkable today. But Harper, the other thing that's interesting about him, he had such a great breakout year last year in which he, you know, had some historic numbers, hit 330 and had 9.5 WAR. If somebody had told you, cause his BABIP last year was 369, that's in line with normal expectations when you have a 330 batting average, that his BABIP would drop to 242, you would think, oh, well, he probably has fallen off this year. He's declined.
He's even better.
He's actually gotten even better, and that's kind of crazy. And it probably can't last, but also at the same time, I think it speaks to just how incredible. There was a story at Fangraphs this past week about how he might actually catch up to Mike Trout. And Mike Trout, as we've written about, is potentially on pace to be one of the greatest players, if not the greatest of all time at this stage of his career.
I don't feel the need to add anything to that, Chad.
I mean, Neil, when are we going to get you a monologue? like just like a sports stat?
I'd be the Vin Scully of...
I think a sports history monologue show where you like Hardcore History or Whistle Stop, which are these sort of more either about military history or political history, a sports history show where Neil just takes us through the story and arc with some numbers mixed in.
Well, Chad, you might have the power to influence decisions in that direction. Or for those listening, if you have an idea, please let me know.
Send your BABIPs to 538's address. All right. Wow, that was really good. My takeaway is that Bryce Harper could get even better this season than
which
he already
is scary.
My takeaway is the Mets are awesome.
There it is. Kate.
I mean, I'm literally wearing a Mets shirt right now. But while I was saying that Bryce Harper, Sig Dig.
All right, I'll put on our usual plug for listeners to listen to Panic City, Neil and my Mets podcast, and let's say that'll do it for this week's show. Kate, thanks for soldiering through your fourth hour. Are you going to make it 5 of being on air?
No, I'm not. I'm going to go now take a nap.
Ooh, even better.
Yes. Thanks,
right.
Chad.
Enjoy. Neil Payne.
Thanks, Kate.
Neil Payne.
Thanks Chad. Thanks, all.
Thanks, everybody.
It's a group thanks.
Thanks.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast ringleader is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcast app. We're also on iTunes. If that is your favorite podcast app, that's okay too. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. While you're there, review and rate our show. Review and rate the Elections podcast. Review and rate What's the Point, our data and society podcast. Review and rate it all. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.